It doesn't solve the problem of even a society.
Yes.
So knowing about them is of no use. But you might say, okay, as for, I don't know, general knowledge, I like to have it. And to say that, okay, if we go into such issues, you know, definitely it comes, I mean, it will continue to some other thing that we have no knowledge of.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if he's married, how many wives does he have?
Yeah.
If he has children, how many children?
Mm-hmm.
If they are eating food, what kind of food do they eat?
Exactly. They would lead to some more of doors to be opened.
And then it will pave the way for those who are going to misuse, again, from this concept of mind.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, based on an intellectual rule, we are following such... What is for our need? I mean, we are in need of. I'm bringing Quranic evidence for that, just to make it close to understanding. We have in Al-Quran that some of the youth in Surah Al-Kahf, some of the youth left their own land and their own cities, and they went to a cave just to save their own religion.
Yeah.
Because they found out that they cannot continue with those circumstances to keep their religion firm. So what did they do? They went to a cave. Then, again, the Quran itself says, some said that there were three, some said that there were seven, some said there were four.
Yeah.
Quran says, what kind of mistake you are actually...
making.
What kind of mistakes you are making? What is important to you?
Mm-hmm.
The base was that they left
exactly
that area for the sake of their religion, for the sake of God.
Mm-hmm.
You are quarreling on the number of the people.
You leave the important thing aside and then go for tribulation.
The core of it is due to the sake and the happiness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, they did something.
Yeah.
We put it aside. We put it aside and we zoom on something which is not important.
Exactly. I guess that's in the nature of human beings, and it has been recorded in all parts of history. They did not go for the important things, for the, as you just said, the core of all the stories, and then they just go for trivial issues.
Definitely.
So this was all the time that we had for today's episode. I'm sure that there are still some more to know, but inshallah we'd cover them in the coming episodes. Thank you, Brother Halabi, and
thank
you to our listeners for being here with us. I hope you just enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow?
Midstream.
The Zionist entity are moving towards the outline of a historic U.S. brokered deal to normalize relations. This is what the White House declared last week. So, the door to normalization between Saudi Arabia and the Israeli entity has now been opened widely, days after Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman spoke of continued progress in the talks on this matter. As soon as the non-resident Saudi ambassador to the Palestinian Authority, Naif al-Sudairi, arrived in the Palestinian territories to reassure the Palestinians about the kingdom's position on the Palestinian right and to visit the Al-Aqsa Mosque, announcements poured in about visits by Israeli entity ministers and leaders in the Knesset to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, starting with the arrival of the Minister of Tourism. The Zionist Chaim Katz visited Riyadh on Thursday, September 19, in the first public visit to the kingdom by an official at this level. And these visits in both directions are considered a quick translation of what the Saudi prince had announced about continued progress in the normalization talks with the Zionist entity, which are taking place within a tripartite framework. After the news of the visit made by the Zionist regime minister of tourism to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Saudi social media users widely criticized this trip with several hashtags, including "We do not accept normalization," "No to normalization," and "Normalization is treason." Where does Palestine fit in all of this? Well, Mahmoud Abbas seemingly believes in the necessity of benefiting from the expected normalization. That was evident when the secretary of the executive committee of the PLO, Hussein Sheikh, headed a delegation that visited Riyadh on the 5th of last month, where he met with Saudi officials to inform them that the Palestinian Authority, despite its adherence to the Arab Peace Initiative, will not stand in the way of the agreement and will not oppose to Saudi position if it had significant financial resources to prevent the PA's collapse. Talk about a good business deal, huh? Anyways, not a word about establishing a Palestinian state. And why would there be, since Benjamin Netanyahu just a week ago announced his complete opposition to the establishment of a Palestinian state in exchange for normalization with Saudi Arabia? All recent events are clear evidence that Riyadh is interested in Tel Aviv and not Palestine or Al-Quds, as it claims. Saudi Arabia already has relations with the Israeli occupation, marked by Israeli entity companies operating in the kingdom, including those responsible for security during the Hajj pilgrimage in Mecca. The kingdom is now keen on establishing official relations with the Israeli entity in order to obtain U.S.-made weapons supplies and attain its own facility for uranium enrichment, which Zionist leaders will find 101 ways to prevent from happening. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The Arab world is on the verge of a new phase that paves the way for the integration of the Zionist entity into the region of the Arabian Peninsula and the abolition of Palestinian national rights. Accordingly, the Palestinian cause has become to certain emirs just an obstacle that must be removed. But is it really a historic agreement between a country like Saudi Arabia and the Israeli entity that is going to be an easy matter? To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mikhail Awad, political commentator and head of the media committee at the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. It's a pleasure having you with us, Dr. Mikhail Awad. Now, Zionist-Saudi normalization is supposedly a done deal. And now, since Saudi Arabia believes that benefits do come from the Zionist entity killing Palestinians, raiding their homes, desecrating their religion, especially the religious places, it is clear that Saudis do not really care about the Palestinian cause or the Palestinians for that matter. So what's the point behind all the Saudi charade of the two-state solution?
It seems to be a public attempt to justify the step of getting involved in the normalization process. Any sane person who follows the Arab-Israeli entity conflict, especially during the past couple of years in the West Bank and Palestine, understands that there is no hope for the possibility of a two-state solution, and that Zionist Israel never commits to any of the promises made in the agreements it usually signs, exactly like what happened with the Oslo Accord. The Israeli regime transformed into the hegemony by the most extreme Zionist group and other extremists who rule and manage it, and carry out amendments in the foundation of the Zionist regime. In addition to the so-called judicial revolution within the Israeli occupation, it is then impossible to provide any conditions for a settlement. Just as the Lebanese proverb says, it is like going to Hajj pilgrimage in the off-season. Now it has become a known fact that normalization is treason and that ties with the Zionist Israel are always for free without any benefits for the signatories besides the Israeli regime, and that all other signatories will come out of these agreements as losers.
Well, Dr. Mikhail, we know firsthand right here in Lebanon that Zionist Israel will be present anywhere it wants or it can get to, for that matter, including the corridors of the Saudi Yamama Palace if it has to. Have the Saudis not yet understood that Israel or the Israeli entity has never made any concessions on any regional issue? Have they not understood that the Zionism demands the establishment of a greater Israel? Have they not even known that the usurping illegal entity is constantly expanding, and that that is why it has never declared its own borders as an entity? Do they not know that they are next on that list?
If they actually go to announce normalization, establish diplomatic relations, raise the Israeli entity flag in Riyadh, and establish normal relations, then they have lost it all. It is not normalization as much as it is an exchange, as normalization is usually between two natural entities. But the Zionist entity is a temporary usurping replacement entity that has no chance of survival and continuity. Therefore, if the Saudi leadership were to legislate normalization and make it official and diplomatic, then the Saudi Arabia would have committed a grave mistake against itself, against Saudi Arabia's regional role, and against sacred religious sites. And in practice, it would have become one of those who do not learn from the experience nor the experience of others. These people are usually described as fools in the world of politics. So if they normalize, they will acquire this description. Yes, the Israeli entity does not make concessions to anyone, does not adhere to pledges, and does not reassure others, even within their own countries. This is what we witnessed, for example, in the United Arab Emirates when it agreed to normalization. And this is what happened and is happening in Jordan, even though normalization is called there. And this is what happened and is happening with Egypt. The most notable evidence of this is how the Israeli entity dealt with the Palestinian Authority, as the agreements that were signed were for the benefit of the occupying entity only. Zionists took recognition from the PLO, held the authority captive to members of its forces, and transformed it into merely a managing committee of prisons inside the West Bank. This is what the Palestinian people have discovered. The same people who are revolting today and snatching up weapons and resistance in a revolution that has only one path, which is liberation from the river to the sea. If the Saudi officials do not know this, do not study this, and do not conclude or feel this, then they will have placed themselves in a dangerous dilemma.
Well, since you mentioned the Palestinian Authority, we all know that the Palestinian Authority, according to experience here, does not work for the Palestinians. It just exists to protect Israel. And that's not me saying it. This is actually evident in the past years when the Zionist aggression against the West Bank in specific was accelerating year after year. So Mohammed bin Salman just throws some cash on the Palestinian Authority as some sort of a hush money to complete the normalization process without any noise. However, is he really deafened? Does he not listen and hear the thunderbolts of the Palestinian resistance operations, especially in the occupied Palestinian territories? I mean, these operations make it impossible for the Zionists to lose more Palestinian land and heritage by the minute. It makes them nearly impossible for them to live in peace while looting Palestinians.
Certainly, if he goes to normalization, it will be in addition to committing foolishness, and it will be the foolishness of the century. Given Saudi Arabia's status and platform in the Arab world and as a religious position for the majority of Muslims, if he goes towards normalization in this circumstance, he will go against all trends. Not only will he be accused of not knowing what is happening around him, and that he is not keen on Saudi Arabia, and that he does not understand the heated upheavals, but he will be the most prominent conspirator against the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people. And at a time when the occupation entity itself is facing an existential and structural crisis. The Palestinian people, 30 years after the Oslo Accords, tested the nature of this entity and became convinced that there is no way to achieve rights except through the option of resistance, which was tested in Lebanon and gave its result in complete liberation, and was also tested in Gaza in 2005 without restrictions or conditions. This means that the post-Oslo generation is the one leading the resistance and its capabilities and circumstances, which is expanding to include more Palestinian cities and governorates, which are beginning to look more like liberated areas just like Jenin. This unique model began to spread in Nablus and in many regions, and in Hebron, Al-Khalil is also preparing to enter the liberation battle. And when it does, there will be developments of a different nature towards comprehensive and complete liberation. for Mohammed bin Salman to finance the Palestinian Authority, which today is known to be nothing more than a security apparatus in the hands of the Israeli entity, to stab the Intifada and the Palestinian people in the side and back. Then he will have presented himself and Saudi Arabia on the altar of the ultimate battle and will have joined the ranks of the losing forces.
Definitely. Well, just leave it in the hands of the resistance and it will take care of it. That's what I believe in, and millions of Muslims and free people of the world do. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mikhail Awad, political commentator, for joining us to discuss the imminent Saudi-Israeli entity normalization. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we will talk about how the resistance in Gaza is snatching its rights from the mouth of the Zionists.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, after long discussions conducted by mediators between the Hamas resistance movement in the Gaza Strip and the Israeli entity, the latter yielded to the Palestinian demands regarding non-escalation in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and a return to previous so-called understandings regarding the economic conditions in the Gaza Strip in exchange for stopping the border activities led by the resistance and Hamas. More details in the following report.
Intensive talks have taken place recently among the Israeli entity, the Hamas movement, the United Nations, Egypt, and Qatar in an attempt to calm the escalation along occupied Palestinian border with the Gaza Strip. For 2 weeks, Palestinians have held massive protests at the border fence every evening, facing off with Israeli occupation soldiers. Protests had broken out after Hamas demanded an end to the pressure exerted by the occupation on the Gaza Strip, after the Zionist regime tightened the blockade measures, which affected the Hamas government's work in the Strip, its ability to provide services to citizens, and to pay the salaries of its employees. The Palestinian demands included doubling the number of workers allowed to work inside the occupied territories, but the Egyptian mediators declared that the Zionist regime will increase the number of workers to 20,000 after it was 17,500 workers, provided the number will reach 30,000 workers over the next year, under the condition that calm prevails in the Strip, linking the public's livelihood in Gaza to the resistance subordination. Also, Hamas demanded an increase in the value of the Qatari grant to cover new numbers of poor citizens, in light of data about the increase in the poverty rate within the Gaza Strip to more than 70% of citizens, according to official and international statistics. Egyptians and Qataris informed the movement that the Zionist occupation has no objection to increasing the value of the Qatari grant to include more than 100,000 citizens. However, the return to protests will depend on the implementation of the pledges made by the occupation to the mediators, according to what Hamas informed the Egyptians, noting that the cessation of demonstrations will be temporary, hinting that the rebellious youth on the Gaza border will escalate their steps if there is an attack in the city of Al-Quds during the Jewish holiday period, which continues until the 7th of next month, and also in the event that the current understandings are not fulfilled. As a result, the occupation forces announced the opening of the Beit Hanun crossing last week to Palestinian workers from the Gaza Strip after a closure that lasted 12 consecutive days, which came as a form of punishment after the escalation of the activities of the Gaza rebel youth on the borders of the Strip. After the occupation announced the opening of the Beit Hanun crossing, the rebel youth announced in a statement that its units will remain on alert and ready to return to the Popular Revolutionary Movement in the event that the enemy does not adhere to its pledges to the mediators. All the while, the Zionist entity continues to fortify many bypass roads leading to settlements surrounding the Gaza Strip by raising high concrete walls and increasing shooting attempts during the demonstrations. These measures, according to the occupation army, aim to prevent the launching of missiles from Gaza towards the interior occupied Palestinian territories in the event of a military confrontation with the Gaza Strip. But experience has shown that the Zionist measures, too, will fail miserably.
Now to discuss this issue with us from the besieged Gaza Strip is Mr. Arafat Abu Zayed, a Palestinian political writer and commentator. It's a pleasure having you with us, Mr. Arafat. Now, Arab media outlets reported that a formula to calm the situation on the borders of the Gaza Strip were reached after the Israeli entity pledged not to escalate in the city of Al-Quds and to return to the Saif Al-Quds understandings of 2022. How do you read these developments, given that the resistance was fully capable of escalating the situation in Gaza? I mean, how come the Zionists decided to de-escalate this time?
First of all, most welcome to you. I believe the state of tension on the borders of the Gaza Strip with the occupying entity comes in its natural context in light of the ongoing state of provocation felt by Palestinian youth and the Palestinian citizen. As a result of what is happening in Al-Aqsa Mosque and Al-Quds al-Sharif and the state of continued Israeli violations against the people of Al-Quds and violations against Islamic and Christian sanctuaries in Al-Quds, it is not surprising to witness this escalation in the pace of resistance activities, whether in Gaza or even in the West Bank and specifically on the border in the Gaza Strip, especially in light of a Zionist project led by extreme Zionists such as Ben-Gavir and Smotrich. By targeting several aspects related to Islamic rituals and beliefs, the most important of which are Al-Aqsa Mosque through continuous raids, as well as the repressive measures against prisoners and detainees and the significant expansion of settlement operations in the occupied West Bank. Therefore, I believe that the Israelis eventually reached the complete conviction that they must end the ongoing violations against Al-Quds and the holy sites, especially since they know fully well that Gaza will not remain silent and will not stand idly by, and that the resistance in Gaza will have the most prominent say. Therefore, in light of the internal crisis experienced by the left and right camps in the temporary entity and the internal Zionist division, the occupation tried to distance itself from the current state of conflict, especially in light of the threat to it on several fronts. There is the southern front represented by Gaza, the northern front represented by Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as Iran and its nuclear program, and the weaker side of the occupation represented by the occupied West Bank. Therefore, the occupation had no choice but to reach understandings through Arab and international mediation.
Well, Mr. Arafat, after the enemy government tightened the blockade and the siege measures on Gaza, we saw that the government, the Hamas government, work was affected heavily by this closure, by the siege, along with its ability maybe to provide services for the citizens, to pay salaries to the employees. This is all due to the illegal Zionist blockade on the entire Gaza Strip. Will this new mediated agreement, in your opinion, be enough to secure the livelihoods of the Palestinian people living under siege in Gaza?
I think the recent understandings and the recent mediation agreement will in no way be sufficient towards providing a decent means of living for the Palestinian people. What's happening is simply just trying to keep the situation as is. There has been a siege imposed on the Gaza Strip for 17 years, and what is currently happening is only an attempt to keep things as they are for fear of the escalation of resistance in Gaza, and the attempt to escalate the fight against Gaza, which in turn will increase the pace of resistance work. What is currently happening is that Qatar, for example, pays $30 million a month to the government in Gaza. Before now, it paid directly to the Ministry of Social Development in the Gaza Strip. But for several months now, it has been paying directly to the United Nations, which disperses it to a number of Palestinian families. But even the amounts spent do not achieve what is required. It is like someone living in a state of clinical death and being put on artificial resuscitation. This is what the Israeli occupation aspires to keep up. But the empty state of siege, in my opinion, will not last long, especially in light of the escalation of resistance work, and in light of the circumstances in which the Israeli entity resides above international law and wants to practice all continuous violations against our people in the Gaza Strip. But the greatest and most reliable guarantor of breaking this siege and breaking the Israeli arrogance will be the resistance, and not the Arab or international mediators who always seek to find solutions that are more in favor of the Israeli occupation.
Well, Mr. Arafat, in documented history, there has really never been a strong Palestinian resistance that could wipe out the occupation force militarily, but through the strategy of attrition and making the occupier pay a very heavy price along a long period of time, new realities were imposed against the Zionist entity that might even lead to the stage of liberation in Palestine. If it were to start, in your opinion, from where do you think the spark of liberation would begin in Palestine, given that at the moment the entire historic map of Palestine seems to be on a very hot plate?
There is already a change in the Israeli entity's map of threats. For example, Benjamin Netanyahu, prime minister of the occupying entity, when he began the new period in the current coalition government, he was talking about the primary threat to the entity, which is the Iranian nuclear program. Then he switched to the trend of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the crisis that Hezbollah placed for the entity on the northern border began. Then Netanyahu and the Zionist security and military apparatus behind him were surprised. They were surprised that the strategic danger and the weak flank of the entity was actually the occupied West Bank. Why do we say the occupied West Bank? Let's talk about the West Bank in numbers. From January, the beginning of this year, until the middle of this year, there were more than 6,705 resistance operations in the West Bank, including shooting operations, stabbing operations, and runover operations, as well as launching missiles and shooting down Israeli occupation drones. There is also a great state of hostilities against the settlers, a large presence of settlers in close proximity to the West Bank, and lines of contact with the occupation soldiers that are almost contiguous. Therefore, the occupation describes the occupied West Bank front as the biggest and most prominent threat to the occupation, especially if we remember the number of Zionists killed this year. The number of deaths as a result of resistance operations this year to date has reached about 35 Israeli settlers and occupation soldiers dead, compared to last year, which was 30 dead, and the year before, that were only approximately 4 or 3 Israeli settlers and soldiers dead. This is evidence that there is an invisible battle taking place within the rising momentum, and indicators of this battle are beginning to become clear in the occupied West Bank. The battle of military industrialization, whose features began to become clear in the recent Battle of Jenin, through which the resistance was able to repel all the occupation soldiers and the entire brigade that the occupation deployed during the battle. This means that the most prominent threat to Israel and the great liberation battle is to start from the weakest flank of the occupation, which is the flank of the occupied West Bank. But in my opinion, the resistance, whether in Lebanon or Palestine in the Gaza Strip, will not remain silent in the face of any violations or any criminal activity carried out by the Israeli occupation against the resistance in the West Bank, as part of its attempts to expand its attack against the resistance in the West Bank. Therefore, we are facing a new phase in which the occupied West Bank will be the epitome of this battle, which may be a liberation battle with the participation of all fronts and arenas, whether at the level of Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, or even the Islamic Republic of Iran and our people inside the occupied territories in 1948. The West Bank represents the most prominent weak side of this occupation, and the occupation is seeking with all its efforts to confront this phenomenon. But it seems that it will not be able to stop the state of resistance in the West Bank, which is constantly on the rise, even according to Zionist security indicators, which fear the continued escalation of the resistance in the West Bank.
Well, Mr. Arafat Abu Zayed, political writer and commentator that joined us from Gaza, first of all, I want to thank you immensely for your contribution and your time. And
thank you,
I want to wish you and all the people of Gaza a Mawlid Mubarak for the Mawlid of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family. Thanks a million for your time. You have no idea how much we appreciate your time and contribution, because you are from Gaza, the place that we aspire to visit first, inshallah, after liberation and after visiting Al-Aqsa, bi-idhnillah. Thanks a million, Mr. Arafat Abu Zayed, for being with us. Ladies and gents, thank you. We'll see you again next week on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Bustle of life.
sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, the head of the race equality think tank, Dr. Halima Begum, says the British government has a major credibility issues with denial of institutional racism. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The outgoing head of Britain's leading race equality think tank, the Runnymede Trust, Dr. Halima Begum, says the continued denial of institutional racism has created a credibility issue for the British government. Dr. Halima Begum, who is stepping down as a director of the Runnymede Trust after 3 years, said that soon after the government released its controversial report on race, which claimed to not find evidence for institutional racism, there were several national scandals that showed otherwise. Every time they denied institutional racism, some other event would happen that showed the realities for people of colour living in Britain. If it wasn't the Casey Review, it was the cricket or the experience of the black England footballers at the Euro competition. Every time there is a denial of racism, it surfaces out again. So no, they were not successful, she said. Dr. Halima Begum added, I would say the more they tried to deny the existence of racism, the more they showed themselves to be not committed to race equality and, in fact, not committed to many people in this country, because the rest of the country could see the disparities. I think it created a bit of a credibility issue for the British government and those that would deny institutional racism. Dr. Halima Begum began her tenure as the head of the Runnymede Trust in 2020, at a time when multiple issues from coronavirus to Black Lives Matter protests were affecting the country. On Black Lives Matter, Dr. Halima Begum says, it felt like we were living through quite a historic and seismic time. It felt so hopeful, but it also placed a tremendous responsibility on those of us who are a bit older to do something, because we know what happens when young people's demands are not met. There's nothing worse than people hitting the streets and then finding out that actually your action doesn't matter. So I was aware that there was a window of opportunity, a very short time span, to try and deliver those demands into outcomes that could change policy and could change the life opportunities for the next generation. The British newspaper, the Daily Mail, has also covered this issue and tells us more. The outgoing head of the Runnymede Trust, the main race equality think tank in Britain, Dr. Halima Begum, says the British government has a major credibility issue with denial of institutional racism. The outgoing head of Britain's leading race equality think tank says the continued denial of institutional racism has created a credibility issue for the British government. Dr. Halima Begum, who's stepping down as the head of the Runnymede Trust after 3 years in the post, said that soon after the government released this controversial report on race, which claimed to not find evidence of institutional racism, there were several national scandals that showcased it. Before the launch of the government's race report, equality groups expressed concerns with the process. But Dr. Halima Begum said Runnymede Trust had engaged fully with the commission. "We were going to make it work. We were going to hold them to account. Now the individuals that they chose perhaps didn't have the best record on race, but you could still work for the process and want better outcomes. Some people might say that's naive, but from an organizational perspective, you have to push it to deliver more." The report, when it finally landed in March of 2021, was widely criticized for playing down the role of structural racism in modern British society. UK bodies that were credited in the report quickly distanced themselves from it, while the United Nations human rights experts described it as an attempt to normalize white supremacy. Dr. Halima Begum said it was startling to see the denial of institutional racism in the United Kingdom. "It was still quite shocking, and the reason why it was shocking to see that denial was because of the twin energy from Black Lives Matter and COVID around the barefaced reality of racism." When the report came out, Dr. Halima Begum was caring for her father, who was being treated for cancer. She added, "Everybody is quick to say, we understand individual acts of racism. That's a bad person, they were racist. But if hundreds of bad people are racist in an institution, it becomes an institutional problem." In response to the Runnymede Trust criticism of the report, more than a dozen Conservative MPs wrote to the Charity Commission demanding an investigation into the organisation. The commission later found the think tank did not breach charity guidance. Dr. Begum said she was receiving death threats at the time and described the attacks on Runnymede Trust as a damning reality. "The idea that a charity organisation set up to speak out against racism wasn't allowed to speak out against racism, that's the tragedy. The political system is so broken that somehow everything feels distorted and you cannot stand for what's right according to your charitable objectives." Still, Dr. Begum feels proud of the work that she was able to achieve at her time at Runnymede Trust. "I'm very proud to have been at an institution that has weathered the storm of multiple fronts of attacks, very proud to be part of an institution that has stood the test of time, and we prevailed."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about
Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are still talking about the dress code or some of the religious laws and the Sharia laws about that based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javed. Sheikh Javed, you know, we received an email asking us this question. Let me just read it for you. My sister is a student. She's 16 years old and a believing girl. She's careful about prayers and other acts of worship. She sincerely wants to wear hijab, but unfortunately, her mother forbids her to wear hijab and tells her that she will fight with her to prevent her from wearing it because she thinks that, you know, she's at a young age, even though she's an adult and duty-bound. The girl's father also sees eye to eye with her mother in this matter. Should the girl insist on wearing the hijab and observing the Islamic dress code?
Well, such a thing does happen in some families with the parents trying to forbid their child not to practice certain obligations because they think she's not at a proper age to do this.
Yes.
And that is a matter of regret. I should say that a matter of, I should say, an unfortunate thing that we can see in some families. Generally speaking, it's not permissible for anyone to prevent someone from acting upon the commandments of Allah, those commandments which are mandatory, which are obligatory. And of course, every individual should carry out his obligation or her obligation, her duties, whether it is observing hijab, whether it is offering prayer or fasting, And of course, one should still, at the same time, should try to be careful not to anger one's parents or not to hurt them. But the parents have no right to meddle with the religious duties. They have no right to forbid their children from praying, fasting, and performing other religious duties. So the children are not supposed to obey their parents when it comes to praying, fasting, and observing hijab.
I see. Sheikh Javid, in one of the earlier programs, you mentioned that a woman is not allowed to use ornaments, let's say, to attract other people's attention. I mean, non-mahram, basically, right? And my question to you is that are a woman's eyes part of her adornment that she can do anything to the eyes, for example, use shadows or any kind of apply cosmetics, you know, to the eyes?
Well, according to an answer I read from His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, a woman's eyes are one of the visible adornments that are excluded from the obligation of covering. So even though it is, you know, a woman's eyes are beautiful, they look attractive, but she's not supposed to cover them, because she has to see things around herself and to walk and not to fall in and trap over, you know.
Yes.
That's it. That's very important. So she's not supposed to cover her eyes.
I see. Well, what's the ruling, Sheikh Javid, on wearing a face veil? Is it obligatory for women actually to obey the orders of her husband or father in this matter?
Well, wearing a face veil is a good thing. It is, there's no, you know, there's no problem or there's no objection to a woman wearing it. And sometimes it can be even better to wear it to protect oneself from the gaze of strangers. But wearing, covering the face is not obligatory in and of itself. It is permissible. It's not obligatory. So a woman is free to choose between covering her face and not covering it.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws about the dress code or hijab and conspicuous clothes based on fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible for a woman in a conservative society in which most women don't reveal their faces, is it permissible for this woman to uncover her face in that a conservative society or community?
Well, it is obligatory for a woman to cover her body other than her face and hands, as we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, you know, important that the circumstances in which a woman lives are carefully considered, and that a woman should avoid wearing, you know, things that are, you know, that make her conspicuous. So basically, you know, it is permissible for a woman to cover her face, and if not covering one's face might attract the attention of strangers,
mm-hmm.
it's better, not obligatory, for her to cover her face.
Mm-hmm.
It is better for us to cover her face in order not to stand out as someone, you know, conspicuous, as someone who is eye-catching. So in order to be immune to the gaze of the strangers, it is better for a woman living in such a society
mm-hmm.
to cover her face.
I see. Sheikh Javed, is covering the neck part of the Islamic hijab?
Of course it is. It is necessary to cover the part below the chin.
Mm-hmm.
But not the upper part of the chin. It is necessary to cover the part which is visible underneath or beneath the chin. And so when it is necessary to cover the part under the chin, it's also necessary by extension to cover the neck. So covering the neck is necessary, even though unfortunately we see that some Muslim women, not in Iran, but in many other Muslim countries which I have been to, they do not take care of their hijab properly. We see that Muslim ladies, despite their being very practicing, they don't have a proper and complete picture of what hijab, Islamic hijab is. So they do not care about their neck. You can see their necks
mm-hmm.
while they are in the streets.
I see. Let me ask you another question before the end of the program, Sheikh Javed. What's the jurisprudential law about a woman wearing thin patterned and colorful socks?
Well, it is forbidden for a woman to show her adornments whatsoever to non-mahrams. And non-mahram means men outside her family. So if something is considered to be adornment, or it's called something zina according to Arabic terminology,
yes. mm-hmm.
then it is not permissible for her to show them, to show her zina or
right.
adornments to non-mahram men.
Okay, thank you very much, Javed, for your nice answers and enlightening us actually with the answers to these questions of religious nature or jurisprudential nature. Well, thank you very much, my dear listeners, for joining us for the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. From me, Muhammad Jawad, and the rest of the crew, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ukraine says 52 people have been killed in a Russian missile strike in Kharkiv, Moscow.